All right, welcome to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Welcome back, everybody. This will be our first committee hearing of the year, and we do have a quorum present. We're going to begin with a couple of overviews today, and we'll go through just a few housekeeping things before that time. Folks will note that we've got our committee rules, that those are in the packet. Also, the staff, nonpartisan and partisan staff are in the committee roster within the packet. So that for folks to have that for the people upstairs and get to know the research staff, for those folks new to the committee, we've got a lot of returning members, veteran members, but we've got a few new folks. So those faces you can connect up immediately. There's just a couple of changes that we had within the committee rules this year. We're starting right after lunch. One of the things about that that's good, because it's generally easier to get here on time. But also, in the past, we had a little bit of difficulty with people bringing lunch in. If you want to bring drinks in, that's fine. But I think from the to be respectful of the testifiers and the rest of the committee members, you have to finish a sandwich or something in your office. We usually don't get to do the business for the first couple minutes anyway, so try to finish that up before you get here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
Just to be clear, that does not include candy, though, right?
No, you can bring candy if you share with the rest of the committee at any time, so you're good. We're still good there. Committee rules and roster are in. Representative Lunan.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm new to this committee. Is there going to be a test on all these acronyms?
Yes.
Only for the new people. Only the new people.
Well, that's a very reduced down
holy cow.
List of the acronyms that you have within that. Ms. Larson put that together for your use, and if it's laminated, she gets extra points for that. Just for folks, Ms. Larson and Ms. Iverson are the committee administrator and the committee legislative assistant for the committee, and you'll get to know them, and they are great to work with. So whatever you have need for, they can help you out with, and can direct you if they don't know where you need to get the answers. The Democrat lead on the committee is Representative Aaron Murphy. Representative Murphy, welcome back. Care to have any opening comments?
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and we're ready to go. We're ready to work. So
ready
let's
to
do
go.
That.
All right, let's go. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. As many on the committee know, I have this bad habit of sometimes reading things or when things are going on. And I noticed that our vice chair has some unique opportunities to impress his power upon the committee, and I was wondering if he could show us the woolsock and mace under item 11 in the rules.
Representative Loeffler, you win the prize, and you were the only one who knows. I put that in there to see if you would read the rules, and you did read the rules. You did not disappoint. So we appreciate that, and
it'll be clear. The woolsock and mace don't need to be in place for the committee to be
They do not need to be in place for the committee to be in proper order.
Representative, that is correct. Albright does not actually need to bring them each time.
No, he doesn't.
To be candid about it, in my discussions with the Lord Chancellor, Dean, who also holds the judge's woolsack, my understanding is that the judge's woolsack actually provides and deems appropriate the modicum of the woolsack and the mace complimentary to the chair, vice chair's committee. So I do look forward to that at some point.
All right. All well and good. All right. We are going to start out with Medicaid, Minnesota Care. I'm sorry.
I'm so sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to call you Lord if that's okay.
That's fine.
Because you brought up the rules. And we talked about the rules ahead of time. I did read the rules. So, for those who have not read the rules yet, please do, because the chair has been really clear about how and when how he expects us to work in terms of how to get a bill scheduled, when he expects amendments, what he's going to do with amendments, his authority to change the rules, which I hope, you know, we could talk about ahead of time if that happens. But he's been real clear in the rules, so let's understand what those are so we can work within them and get our work done.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, you know, that kind of reminded me to say something about this. I know that chairs have the authority to promulgate their rules. It wasn't that long ago when the Democrats were in the majority in the House and put forward the pre-file rule on the floor. At that time, the minority members, then the GOP, were so upset about that rule, about how it was going to squelch discussion and squelch the minority and so on. Well, fast forward, we know that now the GOP has clung to the same rule, the pre-file rule. However, the reason I'm bringing it up is that, you know, I noticed that this committee and Representative Schumacher's committee, the Health and Human Services Reform Committee, both have pre-file rules in the committee. I just want to really raise the issue there, because when you have, so when we were in the majority and that rule was promulgated over my objection, I then removed the pre-file rule from my own committee, saying, you know, there has to be an ability at some point along the way for members to think together, work together, be creative, and offer amendments without having to think about it 24 hours in advance. And I just want to kind of raise that issue, because I'm noticing now that it's just becoming a practice to have a pre-file rule everywhere. And I, you know, perhaps, I mean, obviously the chair has thought about the rules, but I just want to kind of put it out there to you as a suggestion that at some point you might consider, and I hope members who are chairs of other committees will do the same, lifting those rules so that members can actually work together, think about things as discussions are being had, and offer amendments to try to improve bills and not have it be only about thinking about it beforehand in isolation, proposing it, and then being stuck. So thank you for letting me say my piece there.
Appreciate that, Representative Liebling. The first thing we're going to do is kind of get into healthcare access fund and really how that affects Minnesota Care and medical assistance. And you know, our state based programs. We really are going to be looking at federal healthcare reform very specifically in this committee. And the reason for that, obviously, we don't know what's going to happen. But when we look at Medicaid, Minnesota Care, and our premium-assisted individual health insurance policies, they all do flow together for people who are trying to afford health insurance. And to some extent, we're going to be ahead of or behind the curve with Washington, D.C. But one of the things that we really want to make sure that we know about and know where we're at is where we are with our state-based programs and how we're delivering care. And when people talk about the potential loss of federal funding, we are particularly in the soup in Minnesota because of the way the current programs are designed and how they're paid for. And so I want to get members to start out, dig right in, and figure out where we are with federal, with how we're fitting in with federal health care reform, and in my opinion, why we should lead and not follow that in the upcoming year. We have Sean Welch, director from Reports and Forecasts, and Susan Snyder. Also, to just walk through an overview for us, and we can do that, and I would ask that we hold off questions until the end, because we do have a lot of financial and technical data, and it's easy to get very quickly behind. So with that, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sean Welch, and I'm the Director of Reports and Forecast Division of the Minnesota Department of Human Services.
And I'm Susan Snyder, Assistant Director of Reports and Forecasts with Department of Human Services.
Thank you. Thanks for having us here. We're going to go over a pretty high-level overview of the forecasted programs within DHS, and we're going to focus on medical assistance and Minnesota Care, which are the two health care programs that we forecast. So we'll get right into it. On this first slide, this gives you a picture of all of the forecasted programs within DHS. And the title says November 2016 forecast, but this first slide is what actually happened in fiscal year 16. So when we get to future slides and we start to see projections, that'll come from the November forecast. But this slide is a look back to fiscal year 16. The first thing that I want to point out is the four big pieces of this pie are all medical assistance, or as I'll probably slip into, MA, one of the acronyms. And MA is, if you add those four slices of the pie together, it's about 89% of all funds that we forecast within the DHS forecast. So this picture, I should say, this is all funds. This is state, federal, county, any funds that Minnesota Care premiums, anything that sort of is expended through our forecasted programs. So 89% of all the programs are medical assistance. The next biggest slice of the pie is Minnesota Care up there at 4%. And then the rest are a number of mainly cash, food, child care, those types of programs. Within MA, if you look at the dark blue and the green, that comprises about 58% of the entire MA forecast, and those are for elderly and disabled individuals. The dark blue represents long-term care and home and community-based services for those individuals, and the green is their basic care, which is just the traditional health insurance. MA Adults Without Children is the light blue pie, and that's about 13% of our all funds forecast. And if you were to look at the same pie with general fund, the MA Adults Without Children would essentially disappear, because in fiscal year 16, that was an entirely federally funded program. That changes as we move forward, but by the time we get to 2020, that becomes 90% federally funded. The red
there. Excuse me, Mr. Welsh, could you just repeat that last piece?
Sure. The MA Adults Without Children, in terms of all funds, is about 13%. But if we were to look at the same pie just looking at general fund, that slice of the pie would essentially disappear, because in fiscal year 16, that portion was entirely federally funded. That is that changes over time. Beginning in calendar year 17, that 100% federally funding drops to 95%. In calendar year 18, it drops to 94%. In calendar year 19, it drops to 93%. And then in calendar year 2020 and beyond, it's funded at 90%. So we'll see later on, we're going to break that down, the expenditures for that group, in a bar graph that shows the split between state and federal, and you'll see that state share grow over time. So finally, the red piece of the...
Representative Murphy. Yep.
Mr. Chair, just in a follow-up to that, for the testifier, prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, what was the federal contribution to medical assistance?
For the Adults Without Children group? So Minnesota opted for early expansion, and so for a portion of this group is funded up to 138% of poverty. And prior to the implementation of the Affordable Care Act in January of 2014, we funded up to 75% of poverty in MA for that group, and it was funded at 50%. Prior to that, those people were generally funded under general assistance medical care at 100% state funding, or Minnesota Care also at 100% state funding.
Thank you.
Okay, so The red piece of the pie is families with children, basic care in MA. And this group, you'll see, is by far the most number of enrollees, but it's also the lowest cost per capita of all the MA groups. Okay, the next slide. This provides sort of a little context to what you just saw in terms of some numbers here. For medical assistance, the fiscal year 2016 expenditures, all funds, about $10.9 billion. And we served about a little over a million average monthly enrollees in medical assistance. In Minnesota Care, total expenditures, all funds, were about $480 million in 2016, and we served about 115,000 average monthly enrollment in Minnesota Care in that year. Okay, so this breaks the previous slide down, the MA portion of the previous slide, into what we deal with are sort of our three basic eligibility buckets. And those eligibility buckets are adults without children, families with children, and elderly and disabled. And so the pie on the right breaks the $10.9 billion into those three eligibility categories, and you can see that the biggest portion of that $10.9 billion is for elderly and disabled, about $6.3 billion there. That includes the long-term care facilities and waivers and basic care. The adults without kids is the dark blue. That's about $1.6 billion, and families with kids about $3 billion. And you can see the enrollment, the 1 million enrollment, is broken out in the left-hand pie. And you can see that by far the families with children has the greatest number of enrollees at about 690,000 in an average month. What I kind of want to point out here is that the $6.3 billion is about 58% of the total spending in MA, and the roughly 180,000 enrollees who are elderly and disabled is about 17% of enrollment. So we spend about 58% of MA money on about 17% of the enrollment. About two-thirds of the $6.3 billion for elderly and disabled is for long-term care facilities and waivers. The remaining one-third is their basic care. The two groups most impacted by the Affordable Care Act are the adults without kids and the families with kids. So that's the dark blue and the green. If you combine their enrollment, it's about 900,000 individuals in a given month. And that enrollment has increased about 300,000 by about 300,000 people since January of 2014. So the Affordable Care Act has increased enrollment by a fair amount. The blue group, the dark blue group, the adults without kids, we spent about $1.6 billion on them. And as I said earlier, virtually all of that $1.6 billion was federally funded in 2016. Okay. So now we're going to take the enrollment pie from the previous slide, and we're going to show what it looks like over time. So the actual fiscal year 2016, those numbers are from the previous slide, and you can see what happens to enrollment in the three eligibility groups as we go forward through fiscal year 19, the budget biennium. For elderly and disabled, it's growing pretty steadily at about 1.4% average growth per year. That sort of hides a couple of different things that are happening underneath the surface there. Since the ACA was implemented, disabled enrollment has fallen. And what appears to be going on is that prior to the ACA, if you were an adult without children, you know, between ages of 18 and 65, and you needed medical care, you were poor and you needed medical care, the only way that you could get into MA was to become disabled. And so the way you accessed MA was to get a disability determination and go on to the program as MA disabled. Since the MA adults without kids category of eligibility was introduced with the ACA, you no longer need to be disabled in order to access medical assistance. The one exception to that is if you need long-term care waivers, that is not accessible to you through the ME Adults Without Kids door. You need to be disabled in order to access waiver services. But anything else, if you just need basic medical assistance or you need long-term care facilities, you can go in through the Adults Without Kids door now, and there's no asset test, there's a higher income standard, and it provides the same benefit set other than the waivers. So what we've seen is we've seen a diversion of people who would have been ME disabled are now going in through the ME Adults Without Kids door. And so that has tended to increase the Adults Without Kids enrollment faster than we expected, but it's brought the ME disabled enrollment down. And so we've, in the forecast here underlying these numbers, it's a flat projection for the disabled. On the other hand, elderly has grown pretty steadily up until recently. And as of early in 2016, elderly enrollment hopped way above the forecast, and it's continued to diverge. And what's going on here is this is the first sort of sign of the aging population sort of entering our programs. And so we've accounted for that in the November forecast, and we have elderly enrollment growing at about 3% per year into the future. So flat disabled, 3% elderly growth, and you get your elderly and disabled combined growth of about 1.4%. So let's move to the bottom, the dark blue, the Adults Without Children enrollment. You can see that it falls between fiscal year 16 and fiscal year 17 by about 10,000 enrollees. This is due to the impact of the 2016 renewals process. We had about 30,000 people from 2015 who didn't renew for 2016 coverage. And then that's offset by some additional people coming in who weren't covered in 2015. Growth in 2018 and 2019 slows due to the projected impact of the periodic data matching, which is expected to reduce enrollment by about 15,000 people when we get out to fiscal year 19. In the green, the families with children enrollment, they too were hit with the 2016 renewals process. About 28,000 families with children did not renew for 2016 coverage. And in 2018 and 2019, you can see that growth slows off quite a bit. And again, that's due to the projected impact of the periodic data matching, which is projected to reduce enrollment by about 20,000 individuals when we get to 2019. Okay. All right. So this slide is the, you can, if you think back a couple slides ago, we had about $3 billion in all funds expenditures for families with children in MA. And if you look at the actual fiscal year 16 bar, that's your $3 billion. And this gives you a picture of what happens to that expenditure over time. A big piece of what's happening here in this slide is actually a technical issue. It's a managed care shift that has happened every couple of years for the past 3 or 4 years. It's a delay of May capitation payments to be paid in July of every odd year. So it effectively shifts 1 month of capitation out of one biennium and into the next biennium. But the shift is capped at $270 million all funds. So what that does from, you know, from the perspective of this graph is that it artificially increases expenditures in the odd years. It artificially increases expenditures in the even years, like fiscal year 16 and fiscal year 18. And it artificially reduces expenditures in the even years, fiscal year 17. So that's why you get that dip in fiscal year 17. And the value with the families with children of the shift is about $170 million. So one way to get a sort of a clear picture here would be to subtract $170 million from fiscal year 16, add it to 17, and subtract it from 18. And then you'd get sort of a better look at the trend. If you do that, These expenditures are projected to grow on average about 5% per year from fiscal year 16 to fiscal year 19. That's sort of getting rid of that technical shift. The next slide is the adults without children. It's the same thing with the adults without kids. Think back from that pie graph. The $1.6 billion for this group is shown in the actual FY16 bar, that first one on the left. And you can see that it's virtually entirely federally funded, which is the dark blue portion. You can also see that as you go forward in time, the green, the state funding starts to increase, and by the time we get to fiscal year 19, we're expending about $118 million for this group. The average annual growth for adults without kids is about 2% from fiscal year 16 to fiscal year 19. And incidentally, for this group, because we had 100% federal funding, we did not implement that managed care shift, which is why this looks relatively smooth, this growth. The next slide is elderly and disabled basic care. So this is the same slide for elderly and disabled basic. And back from the pie graph from a number of slides ago, we had $6.3 billion spent on that group. Excuse me. This is the basic care portion of that, which I said was about a third. So it's a little over $2 billion. And that's the bar for actual fiscal year 16 to the left. And you can see for this group, we're about 50% state, 50% federal. This group, the expenditures are expected to grow about 8% per year on average from fiscal year 2016 to fiscal year 2019. The higher growth for this group is in part due to what I mentioned before, the higher elderly growth in the elderly population. What's happening here is that the new elderly population is coming in, and there's two types of elderly enrollees there. They're in the community or they're in institutions. The new growth that are coming in is almost exclusively in the community, and the community has a much higher capitation payment, a much higher managed care payment due to PCA and nursing facility risk being put into the capitation payments. So just to give you an idea, the average elderly capitation payment is about $850. A community payment is about $1,000, and an institutional payment is about $500. And so we're getting a bunch of new elderly enrollees into the program. They're all in the community. They're all being capitated at about $1,000. And that case mix is causing the growth, a part of the growth, that 8%. The next slide, so just to give you an idea of the functional workings within reports and forecasts, I'm in charge of the MA basic care and the Minnesota care projections, and my assistant director, Susan Snyder, is in charge of the long-term care facilities and waivers, so she's going to handle this slide.
Sure, so this slide shows expenditures on long-term care. Again, almost all of these expenditures are for the elderly and disabled. These are divided into facility expenditures, which are nursing homes and intermediate care facilities for the developmentally disabled, and home and community-based services, which are waivers, waivers for the elderly waiver, or waivers for the disabled. These are services that help people stay in the community for people who are at risk of nursing facility or ICF or hospital placement. These services also pay for personal care assistance and home care nursing and home health agency services. And you can see in fiscal year 16, we spent in total about $4.2 billion on these services, these waivers, home care services, and facility payments. And that's expected to grow to $5.3 billion in fiscal year 19. Facilities are about 22 to 24% of these payments, so the bulk of these payments are for home and community-based services. Our payments are divided pretty evenly between federal and state share. There is a small county share for certain facility placements. The annualized growth in payments that we're expecting between fiscal year 16 and fiscal year 19 is about 7.7%, so 7.7% growth per year. That's divided between recipient growth and average payment growth. Recipients are expected to grow around 4%, and that's all on the waiver and home and community-based services side. Growth in facilities is pretty flat. On the average payment side, we're expecting growth overall in facilities and waivers to be around 3% per year.
All right. So now we move to Minnesota Care. This is Minnesota Care enrollment, and it's broken out by families with children and adults without children. Minnesota Care now, as the state's basic health program, essentially covers adults without children between 138% and 200% of poverty, and parents also between 138% and 200% of poverty. There are a few thousand 19 and 20-year-olds between 138 and 200% of poverty in that group as well. So the first thing that you can see here is the drop in enrollment between fiscal year 16 and fiscal year 17. And there are two sources of that drop. One is the impact of the 2016 renewals. And the second is stricter enforcement for non-payment of premiums beginning in June of 2016. We had, I think, about 10,000 enrollees that were terminated from the program due to non-payment of premium in that month. The projected impact of the data match for the Minnesota Care is about 3,500 enrollees in fiscal year 2019, and that's why you see enrollment dropping from 18 to 19 by about 1,000 enrollees. Average annual growth in Minnesota Care is about 1% from fiscal year 17, that low point, through fiscal year 19, 1% per year. So here's where the big changes happened in the November forecast in Minnesota Care funding.
Excuse me, Mr. Walsh.
Mm-hmm.
Quick question, Representative Lunan.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Walsh, for the non-pay, so are they subject to the same lockout and have an enrollment period, or how does that, or can they just reinstate with payment?
Mr. Walsh.
Mr. Chair, Representative, they can reinstate if they pay their premium. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, so Minnesota Care funding. So Minnesota Care is funded by three basic sources, federal BHP funds, state health care access funds, and enrollee premiums. In fiscal year 16, you can see that about $30 million of the funding. So total funding for Minnesota Care in fiscal year 16 was about $480 million from a number of slides ago. And that's broken down by about $30 million in enrollee premiums, about $115 million in state funds, and about $335 million in federal BHP funding. What you can see happening over time here is that the enrollee premiums increase, the state funds decrease, and the federal funds increase. And so what's going on here is that better enforcement of the non-payment of premium had an enrollment impact, but it also has an impact on the amount that we collect. And beginning in fiscal year 17, we are projecting to collect about $10 per member per month more than we collected in fiscal year 16 because of this better enforcement. And just to give you an idea, that means in fiscal year 16, we collected about $29 per member per month in enrollee premiums. We're now projecting to collect about $39 per member per month going forward.
Mr. Walsh, could you repeat that, the per member per month average collection of total premium, is that?
Yes. Yep. In fiscal year 16, we collected about $29 per member per month in enrollee premiums. And going forward, beginning in fiscal year 17, we're projecting to collect about $39 per member per month.
And Mr. Walsh, just from my calculations, that's just over 6% of the total cost of the program. Is that 6% going to go up or going to go down as a percentage of total cost of the program?
I believe it will go up a little bit. It will go up a couple percentage points.
But still well under 10% of the total cost of the program.
Mr. Chair, correct.
Which will require 93 to 95% subsidy. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I'm not quite sure I understand. So by the time, I don't have it in front of me, but by the time we get out to fiscal year 19, I think the revenue share, you know, we could do the math here, is somewhere around 7%, and I believe the state share is about 2%, and the rest is federally funded, about 90, 91%, something like that.
Correct. So the subsidized portion, be it state or federal, is approximately 95% of the cost of the program.
The subsidized, Mr. Chair, what do you mean by the subsidized portion? Are you talking, are you including the enrollee premiums?
No.
Oh, I'm
just the, I think the portion, the cost of the program that is not paid for by the enrollee is subsidized. And that it's currently at about 96% or 94%, and that may go up under these calculations a little bit so that it might be a 95.
Mr. Chair, in fiscal year 19, sort of at the far end of this picture, I believe the total of the federal share and the state share of total payments would be about 91% federal and about 2% state. So it would be about 93% in fiscal year 19.
All right. Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, you know, it's a little different question than what the chair is asking, but before the ACA, could you just give us a kind of a general idea of what these bars would have looked like? I mean, am I correct in understanding that there would have been a lot more state money and a lot less federal money? I know there was some federal money supporting Minnesota Care, but could you just kind of describe that real quickly for us?
Mr. Walsh.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, a lot has happened to Minnesota Care through the ACA implementation. So there were a lot more people on Minnesota Care. Minnesota Care used to cover children up to 275 of poverty, used to cover parents and adults without kids. And so within those groups, there were some, the kids and the parents were traditionally covered under a federal demonstration, an 1115 demonstration waiver. And those groups receive 50% federal funding. The adults without kids on Minnesota Care, prior to the early expansion in 2011, they were funded with entirely state funds. And beginning in 2011 with the early expansion, the adults above 75 of poverty who stayed in Minnesota Care, who didn't move to MA, they were included under the 1115 demonstration waiver, and so they received 50% federal funding.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your presentation. Just, you know, one of the things about MA is, based on my memory, I think last biennium it was growing at close to 20% a biennium. Do you know what the state share is projected to grow? You know, you said certain programs, 7.7 per year, 8% per year. What's the overall growth rate projected in the next biennium of MA spending for the state? Do you have that?
Mr. Walsh.
Mr. Chair, Representative, let me, I might.
Compounded if possible.
I don't know that I have that. So what I can tell you is that in the November forecast for the MA program, this is just general fund now. This is not all funds, which is what we've been looking at here. It's growing about, it grows about anywhere from 5 to 8% per year when you get out to 2019 to 2021, which sort of does away with these shifts. And that includes everything in medical assistance, long-term care facilities, waivers, and all the basic care for the three eligibility groups. Now, that's annual growth, not biennial growth.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think our budget is, our growth of revenues is about 4%, if I remember right, from past sessions. So if we're growing 4% per year, if I remember right, from MMB, so if we're growing our revenues total in the state at 4%, but MA is growing at 5 to 8% per year, I don't see how that's sustainable in the long run without some major reforms.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I noted that when we were on the long-term care facilities and waivers, you had said that the enrollment growth was about 4%, but that the payment growth was about 3% per year. And could you tell us what you factor into that? Is it just utility costs or, you know, capital costs? You know, we keep hearing that there's a workforce shortage, which I don't know that it will be resolved with a 3% growth rate overall. And so what do you factor into when you're figuring out that payment growth?
That's nice.
Chair, Representative, we stick to a current law forecast, so we're factoring in what increases are possible under current law. And a lot of, because there are so many different types of programs within long-term care, a lot of times the growth comes from shifts in usage between one type of program or another. So as far as talking about details about what's considered in the average payment growth, if there's any allowance for growth in payments due to costs, that is factored into the forecast.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the general sense then is that it's more about what kind of services. If people are using more customized living or assisted living versus, you know, a home care visit or something like that, but it's not necessarily the cost of providing the services. Is that a fair summary? Unless we've authorized a rate increase.
Ms. Snead.
Chair Representative, yes, that's fair.
Representative Leland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, as everybody probably will recall, in the last session, the legislature passed a big nursing home payment reform. Mm-hmm. And it made nursing homes, instead of coming back every 2 years for an appropriation, they're now on a cost-based system. And I'd like to know, how does that figure in here? Where do we see that? What is the, I know that might be a little hard to project right now, but is that in here somewhere, or how do you see that going out into the future?
Ms. Snyder.
Chair Representative, we have factored that in. That rate increase started in January 2016, so it's partly in our fiscal year 16 data. And because rates are now cost-based, we have rates growing roughly around the rate of inflation, assuming costs will grow about at the rate of inflation, general CPI.
Okay. So that you're just, excuse me, Mr. Chair. From what I'm understanding, you're just using that as an assumption to do the projection forward. And I assume, though, that you'll be monitoring this really carefully so that we can get a real read on what this is doing to our budget, right? And when would you be able to come back to us with sort of the next update about what this is doing to the cost trajectory?
Ms. Snyder.
Chair, Representative, we do monitor that very closely. And with each forecast, we're looking at the most recent data on what actual payments to nursing facilities have been and how they are changing over time with respect to costs.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may. So I think you're saying you won't really have another update for us until the next forecast. Is that kind of, you know, I'm wondering when I can find out next about, you know, how this is tracking.
Chair, Representative, we will be updating this in the February forecast. And I don't know if there's additional information that the nursing facility rates people provide on a regular basis. Perhaps not. So with each forecast, we'll have the February forecast and then future forecasts.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question regarding what savings for our healthcare system are embedded into what we subsidize. When MinnesotaCare was created, there was a sense that we spent a lot on uncompensated care and we spent a lot on the uninsured in Minnesota, and that by subsidizing health care for the working poor in our state, that the system throughout, both private pay and public pay, we're going to see benefits. And I think we've seen some evidence of that. Is that something that the state measures in any way in terms of rates of uncompensated care that these subsidized plans help with?
Mr. Walsh.
Mr. Chair, Representative, to the extent that some savings occurs outside of the forecast, it's not captured anywhere in these slides. It's not captured in our forecast. It accrues to wherever uncompensated care, for instance, that would accrue to the hospitals, and it wouldn't be accounted for in the forecast.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh, and Representative Halverson. I think we'll probably hear a lot more testimony about that this year as we look at our total spend. Total spend is going up. If you look at uncompensated care from the Hospitals Association, I'm sure that they're going to be present where they are with that. I think the evidence early is that uncompensated care is down slightly. However, ED expenditures and visits have not changed the way we thought, and overall costs obviously have not changed the way that we thought. But we're going to be looking at that, I'm sure, over the months ahead. So I appreciate that question. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Walsh, on your slide number nine, forgive me if you've already explained this, but I just have a couple questions. The first is with regard to the growth of the volume of dollars going through long-term care facilities and waivers. I'm just wondering if you can give me a point of reference in terms of the number of participants that would reflect for each one of those intervals.
Mr. Walsh.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm going to let Ms. Snyder handle this one. We'll look it up here quick.
Ms. Snyder.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have about 16,000 people average monthly in facilities, so nursing homes and intermediate care facilities. And we have about 65,000 people who we are making waiver payments or other home and community-based service payments like personal care assistance or home care nursing. So total around over 80,000 people average monthly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Attendant to that, then, with that same slide, then, I'm just wondering to what extent that you can give us any observation in terms of if the ACA stays the same as it is now and what we know, this is what the funding will be, either from the state share or the federal share. But what amount of either the federal share or the state share is at risk if changes are made or a remodeling or a reformation to the ACA at the federal level? What happens then?
Ms. Snyder or Mr. Welsh?
Mr. Chair, Representative, are you referring to specifically long-term care facilities and waivers, or are you referring to other pieces of the MA forecast as well?
Mr. Chair. I am speaking specifically to long-term care facilities and waivers.
Ms. Snyder.
Mr. Chair, Representative. There should not be much of an impact from the ACA on the long-term care part of the forecast, as these, again, these are services that are almost entirely paid for elderly and disabled recipients.
Can I jump in here, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Welsh.
One possible exception to that is going back to what I described has happened to the disabled. If a repeal of the ACA includes elimination of the MA Adults Without Children category of eligibility in Minnesota, then it is likely that a number of these people who would have been MA disabled, who instead became MA Adults Without Children, would go ahead and get a disability determination and enter the program as an MA disabled individual. And I think our estimates are maybe we've had as much as 20,000 individuals who have been diverted from MA disabled into the MA Adults Without Children bucket over the past few years. And so to the extent that that happens, that they enter MA as a disabled individual instead of an Adults Without Children individual, they would have access to waiver services as a disabled individual. Now, we haven't built in, I don't know what we would, how we would handle that in such a fiscal note, but there's at least the possibility then that additional waiver services, you know, could be used.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Welsh, so you speak of the ease with which those adults entered through that portal without verification or underwriting. Would you say that the same level of confidence for those people going through the disability waiver is there, or are they at risk of falling through the cracks?
Mr. Welsh. Chair, Representative, it would be on them to come, you know, to get a disability determination and to reapply to MA as a disabled individual. We would probably anticipate that a number of them would, because that would have been the door they would have come into initially had it been the only door. So we feel like those are the people who need the basic care services or need long-term care facility services. And so we feel like that's a pretty motivated group of people.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And actually, I think to follow up with Representative Halverson's point that when we came in with the Minnesota Care, what effect that had, and my understanding, her question had to do with the dollars. I would have be looking for information having to do with the headcount of what behavior changed as far as people took advantage of it. It seems to me that the problems we're talking about in here will be problems that will always be here, and so any opportunity we have to improve will be based on how we do things, not whether we do them or not. There's an inevitability built into all of this. But it's impossible to know what's a better thing to do going forward if we don't look back and see the things that we've tried in the past, what effect they had, if there's components of that we should keep, if there's things we should throw away. So where do we go, or where do I go for, maybe I'm the only one on the table that doesn't know this, what behavior changed for people as far as, you know, unfunded care, unpaid for care, and when Minnesota Care came in, the headcount or the number of people that now purchased the insurance, and that problem got, if not solved, at least improved. That was a fuzzy question. Let me tighten it up for you.
Okay.
Do you have the per capita numbers on? Okay, so there's a head count of how many people come in. Forget the dollars. How many people go in and they can't pay for or don't pay for the care they receive? It gets cost shifted somewhere. Minnesota Care came in and was partially designed to improve that situation. Do I have that right?
I believe that's correct, Mr.
Okay, then how much did it work, or do we know?
Thanks, Representative Loon, and I think that question probably has two parts, one the reimbursement and one the actual uptake. Reimbursement rates for Minnesota Care are going to be lower than the reimbursement rates for the private health insurance market. But on the other side, on the uptake side, if consumer behavior actually changed, if they were getting treatments ahead of time, or particularly if they were getting preventative care and screening, that was, you know, what, you know, basic coverage was trying to prevent downstream spending. And I think that the evidence is somewhat mixed, and we're going to find that out. But just in terms of program growth, I think Mr. Welsh has pretty good numbers on just the headcount growth within this packet, but also overall expenditures. But probably Mr. Welsh's numbers and experience don't go to as much to utilization. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yeah, that's correct. I was going to say we know a fair amount about the people that are on our programs, but we know basically nothing about the people who aren't. And so in terms of what's happening outside of the system of the forecast here, there will be more qualified people will come to this table than me to address that.
Thank you.
And just as a finish up, Mr. Chairman, I come from an insurance background, and when they take a look at, obviously, the premiums they charge, the costs they incur have a relationship to the losses they have, and losses have two components to them, a frequency, a likelihood, in other words, how many claims are we going to have, and then a severity, what are the dollar amounts of the claim that we're going to have. And both of those data points are direct important factors, and so we want to make sure we're looking at both of those, how people are behaving, and then once they have a claim, what are the costs recurring, or the what's getting reimbursed.
Thanks, Representative Lunan. And I just have two clarifying questions from the presentation on, first of all, if you could explain, Mr. Welsh, just for particularly for the new folks on the committee, what periodic data match is and why do we do that?
Mr. Chair, periodic data match was passed a couple sessions ago, and so right now we have annual renewals. So every year an enrollee has to submit a renewal in order to continue coverage, and they have to sort of, you know, the renewal basically shows that they're still eligible for the program and they're still eligible for their coverage. If circumstances change in between that renewal, in between initial eligibility and that renewal, or in between one renewal and the next renewal, the enrollee is supposed to come in and report that change. The periodic data match is a system whereby the state will check records, will check tax records, will check. I'm not exactly sure how this is going to play out in terms of the implementation, but essentially the concept is we check records, we check the IRS, and we ping other data hubs, verifying the information that we have on file for that person is still current. And so the way that it impacts the forecast is that if somebody doesn't realize that they need to report a change, or their income changes and they don't think it's enough to make a difference, or they're, you know, for whatever reason that change isn't reported, the periodic data match is going to catch that between the renewal periods, and will, if that change leads to ineligibility, it will save eligibility months, you know. And I believe that the fiscal note assumed that it would save, on average, about 3 eligibility months per person where it was determined that they were, in fact, ineligible because of a change that was not reported.
Thank you, Mr. Welsh. And we are doing that so that we make sure that as people no longer qualify, if they get a job or a second job and they're making more money than what the requirements for the program say, they don't qualify anymore, that we don't have to pay for their premium if they're not qualified to be on the program. And I think the legislative auditor found that quite a few folks were ineligible for programs for which the state was providing subsidy. And that's kind of what we're trying to get at. And one of the things that was When you said that we're anticipating 20% or 20,000 people, up to 20,000 people in that will be reduced as a result of periodic data match. So they go through and check, nope, you're no longer qualified, you're off the program, you're reduced down. Do you know, does MMB reflect that in this current tracking? Are we tracking 20,000 less people on how much money we're projected to spend, or do we not track that?
Mr. Chair, those people are effectively removed from the forecast. So within this forecast, within these expenditure numbers, it accounts for the fact that those 20,000 people are no longer enrolled.
That's reduced. All right. Thank you so much. Further questions? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Murphy first.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. We were talking a little bit about eligibility, who would be covered, et cetera. Representative Albright asked you a couple of questions, and I know you already can't answer the question that I'm going to ask you. So I'll just say that part. But one of the possibilities that will happen out in Washington, D.C., is that they may choose to block grant medical assistance altogether, which for those of us at the state level would give us, I think, probably more authority, but it also means who's covered in medical assistance, which categories of people are covered in medical assistance, could change based on state-level decision-making. So when I think about who's in medical assistance, we know it is a broad swath of Minnesotans, kids and families without kids and people with disabilities and people who are aging. So there's a pretty big chunk of the people in Minnesota that could see their status changed. And so I guess I won't put the hypothetical question to you. I think it's important for the committee to recognize that we are, I think, in this committee going to have the job of evaluating where we are today in terms of coverage and cost and, you know, who's of value and who may not be of value. And for those of us who have been doing this work for a while, Representative Loon, and I was a baby organizer when Minnesota adopted Minnesota Care. And I, you know, worked with Representative Dean to find coverage for people who lost their coverage in general assistance medical care. I feel like we're going to revisit all of those decisions again, or we could be revisiting all those decisions again as we move forward through this session, which is, it could be a great conversation because we evaluate and say we're doing the right thing here in Minnesota and we're going to stick to it and we're going to push the Congress to continue the funding as is, or it could be something else. And if it's something else, then I want to say to the people who are here in the audience and those who may be listening, I don't think silence is a very good response to the potential changes. So I sure hope that we are hearing from hospitals and clinics and health plans and providers about what these changes could mean, not only for the way that we do our work in Minnesota, but for our regional economies, for the communities that we represent, especially in greater Minnesota, where hospitals and nursing homes are large employers. We could be doing some significant damage if we're not careful to the healthcare economy of the state of Minnesota. And we have been, and we talked about this earlier today in the Health Policy Committee, we have not been working together very well. I think our legislature has been more polarized and politically polarized on the issue of healthcare than has always been the case. And there's a lot at stake for people who are vulnerable in the state of Minnesota. So I hope that we bring that spirit of curiosity and the value of inclusion and the care for people to the debate as we are wrestling with what I think could be a real difficult challenge coming from Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. And the slide up that's up there right now is really why I wanted to start off this year on page 11 with this particular presentation. And why, when the discussion around premium relief is out there, that I am very reluctant and get very leery about the healthcare access fund is that great big gigantic green bar on the right, which is the federally forecasted funds for Minnesota Care, you say, well, Minnesota is different from other states. How? And the, one of the ways that we're very, very different is with the basic health plan, that we're an outlier. And so I look at those as very at-risk dollars federally. So we have to figure out what kind of soup we're going to be in if we have to make a move on changing where we're going with that. So that's kind of why we're here and why we're talking about this right off the bat. So appreciate that, Representative Murphy. Representative Considine.
Actually, not a question. As a new member, I just wanted to say thank you for delving into that match point and explaining it. I wasn't. Thanks for getting that done.
All right. Other questions? Representative Backer.
Yeah, Chair. My question deals with, you were answering a question about people meeting a certain criteria. My question is each year when you reevaluate those criteria, what does the department do to verify that those, that information being shared to you is correctly so they qualify for the right program? That the data that you're being provided by the individual or family is accurate? Do you know that answer, how you check that? Or do you just take the word, what's on piece of paper?
Mr. Walsh?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not the person to answer that question. I don't know if we have anybody here.
I think, Mr. Walsh, I think Anna Peterson from MMB is going to be coming up, and we can talk a little bit about eligibility determination if you like. We don't, and that might be a good segue into the next presentation and the Healthcare Access Fund. But as part of the job of MNSHR is for eligibility determination, and certainly between Minnesota Department of Revenue and the IRS, that is, you know, how we go back and circle back on that. Mm-hmm. But also we're asking people to estimate what they're going to make in the upcoming year, and then there is a true-up of whether or not that actually occurred, that, that we will, you know, we bumped our head on in the past, and we'll likely discuss that again. So if there's no further questions, are you folks able to hang out for the rest of the presentation if we do have questions after Ms. Mingy's presentation?
Mr. Chair, yes.
All right. That'll be great. Thank you. So next we have Anna Mingy from MMB. And welcome to the committee, Ms. Mingy. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony as you cue that up.
Good afternoon. I'm Anna Mingy. I'm an executive budget officer with Minnesota Management and Budget.
As Ms. Mingy presents, gets that teed up, this, again, for the Healthcare Access Fund is the fund that accepts the 2% provider tax as well as two other sources of revenue that goes for, used to go just for Minnesota Care, but primarily, but we use it for lots of different sources now. And I see Ms. Mingy is teed up to start out on revenue sources, which is great. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as you mentioned, I'm going to give a quick overview of the Healthcare Access Fund, outlining the main sources of revenue into the fund, the way we use that revenue, some recent changes, and then a general outlook for the fund across our forecast horizon. The Healthcare Access Fund was established in the early 1990s to increase access to healthcare, contain healthcare costs, and improve the quality of healthcare services. There are, as you mentioned, a few primary sources of revenue into the fund, the largest being a 2% tax on gross revenues for providers, and specifically for hospitals, ambulatory surgical centers, providers, and wholesale drug distributors. And that tax provides about 80% of the revenue into the fund in the fiscal year 18-19 biennium. The next largest revenue source is a 1% tax on premiums for our nonprofit HMOs, and that provides about 11% of revenue into the fund. We also collect premiums on Minnesota Care enrollees, as Mr. Welch just discussed. And there's a small amount of federal match on our administrative expenditures also deposited into the fund.
And Ms. Mingy, it's important that's the biennial total. That's the previous presentation was annual, and this is biennial.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Thank you. The next slide is also a biennial look at expenditures out of the Health Care Access Fund and expenditures and transfers, so the way that we use the revenues we collect. The largest expenditure in the fund after the November forecast is medical assistance. Permanent medical assistance spending was established in the Health Care Access Fund in 2013. As we've discussed, there were a number of eligibility changes made at that time, and some people who had historically been eligible for Minnesota Care became eligible for medical assistance, and so these appropriations were established then. Minnesota Care represents 12% of the expenditures out of the fund. That's $114 million on the biennium. I wanted to note that 114 is a combination of both enrollee premiums, the $94 million that we collect, that we forecast to collect in the next biennium, and then a $20 million of state share. There's also a transfer to the general fund of $122 million per year that's forecasted, sort of if the balance of the fund allows it, and it currently does. And what that transfer is, it's kind of has a complicated history, but basically our providers and HMOs that are serving public program enrollees are subject to the 2% provider tax and the 1% HMO tax, and we fund that through a rate increase to these providers or to these health plans. And what that means is that the general fund is paying a rate increase through medical assistance, which is essentially being deposited in the Health Care Access Fund through the provider tax revenue. So what this transfer represents is just the revenue being sent back to the general fund. There are also is administrative spending in the fund for the Department of Human Services to operate the Minnesota Care Program, for the Department of Health for a number of activities, including the State Health Improvement Program, all of their operations to manage or to sort of research the healthcare market, and a number of rural health initiatives. And then all other spending in the biennium is just $9 million, and that's a variety of small administrative appropriations. Next, I wanted to discuss how the outlook and status of the fund has changed since the end of session when we talked about it last. At the end of session, we forecast a balance of $533 million in 2017 and $936 million in 2019. And after the November forecast, the balance in each of those biennium has improved. We now expect the budgetary balance in 2017 to be $705 million, which is $172 million above our end of session estimates. And in 2019, we expect the balance in the fund to be $1.4 billion, which is about $446 million above our end of session estimates. And not included on this table, but certainly of interest, is in fiscal year 2021, the anticipated balance in the fund is $1.2 billion. So as the table illustrates, the forecast changes in November were driven almost entirely by expenditure changes, and those occurred almost entirely in Minnesota Care. So as Mr. Welch just discussed, the state share for Minnesota Care fell significantly after the November forecast. In the current biennium, it fell by $166 million over previous estimates, and in the next biennium, it fell by $283 million over previous estimates. And this is primarily the result of higher premiums on the individual market, and because our federal reimbursement for Minnesota Care is pegged sort of to what the rates are on the individual market, to the second lowest silver plan that someone can access. So as a result of these changes, Minnesota Care is now expected to be about 90% federally funded. And these chart, the bars on this chart, the bar on the left is sort of the breakout of the program as of end of session, and the bar on the right is our forecast as of November, and it's for the 2018-19 biennium. You can see that the total program cost fell, and then the federal share grew, and both of those had the result of shrinking the state cost of the program. I also wanted to discuss a contingent provider tax reduction that is contained in law. Minnesota statute contains a provision to reduce the provider tax if the Health Care Access Fund meets a set of certain conditions. So every year, MMB calculates the structural balance of the Health Care Access Fund to determine the provider tax rate for the next year. The analysis calculates the ratio of revenues to expenditures plus transfers, and we base that on the current biennium. So when we did this analysis in 2016, we did it in November of 2016, and we looked at the ratio for the 16-17 biennium, and we were determining the tax rate for the 2017 tax year. And if the ratio exceeds 1.25, which is to say if our revenues are 125% of our uses, then we bring down the provider tax for the next year to reach that 125% balance. For tax year 2017, the ratio we calculated was 1.08, so there was no reduction triggered in that year. The calculation for 2017 was a little more complicated than what I just described because there was a portion of uses that we had to exclude from the transfer. So if you want to replicate it, I can send it to you. It's a little harder than what I outlined, but it's because it follows a formula in law. But it was the result was 1.08 and no reduction of the provider tax. And then finally, I just wanted to
Ms. Bingy, before you continue on, could you talk again about the contingent reduction in the provider tax with the accumulated balance? You said for 17, it's 1.08, so it didn't reach the trigger. If you could follow up and send the calculation that you're referring to with as much detail as possible, that would be really good. And then also looking ahead for 18, about the projected fund balances and whether or not that will precipitate a reduction in the overall provider tax moving ahead.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to follow up with the detail, kind of the background on the calculation. In terms of the 2018 tax rate, if we were to calculate the ratio right now based on the 2018-19 forecast, the ratio of revenues to expenditures plus transfers in the fund is 1.7, which would meet the threshold for a tax reduction. It's hard to say what might happen in intervening forecasts and legislative sessions, but right now, under the current forecast, it does meet the threshold.
Okay. And if you could follow up with that, that would be awesome. Thank you. Please continue.
So as sort of my last slide, I wanted to talk about the outlook for the Health Care Access Fund. We talked at the beginning about the provider tax being the primary source of revenue into the fund, and that tax is scheduled to sunset on December 31st of 2019, which is halfway through fiscal year 2020. And the chart on this slide shows the structural balance in the fund. So the revenues or the sources are the dark blue line, and the uses or expenditures and transfers are the green line. You can see that from 2017 until 2020, revenues exceed expenditures. My slide got a little, my slide got tweaked, but I will send you updated copies. Revenues exceed expenditures from 2017 to 2020. But that in 2021, expenditures exceed revenues by $321 million. So I'm sorry I'm thrown off, but the chart is showing uses as above sources, so I'll send a corrected slide. But I think the primary, the takeaway is that we have a positive structural balance right now, and we'll have a structural deficit by 2021 of $300 million.
Yeah, we want to see those revenues go away in 2020 there.
Well, Mr. Chair, the revenues in 2020 are still higher, even though it's a partial year of tax revenue, they'll still be higher than expenditures. And in 2021, they will be significantly lower, but there still will be some revenue in the fund. That is the kind of the end of my prepared presentation, but I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Backer.
Yeah, this goes back to my past question. With medical assistant and MinCare, what's done to look at the eligibility to make sure the numbers that are being presented, the people are, it's accurate information, so that they're put into the right pool, you know, into the right program, or people are not taking advantage of the system and they're getting a particular health in one of the health care programs that they really don't qualify for?
Yes, Minky.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the eligibility determinations are kind of conducted by the Department of Human Services, so I would defer to their expertise on that.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Johnson, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I'm Chuck Johnson, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Human Services. I'm not the eligibility expert. I can give you sort of the high level, and if you want more information, we can certainly get that to you. When someone applies for a public health care program who is in the two larger groups that Mr. Welch talked about, the adults, the kids, and the families with children, we do data matches against external data sources. So we use tax data, Equifax, which is a wage reporting system, Social Security Administration data, and then also for our initial application, we use deed data, the data that deed collects on wages paid to individuals. That's matched against the information we get from the applicant. If there's a substantial difference, the applicant has to demonstrate it to us why there's a difference between what we're seeing in these external data sources and the information they presented for us, which will happen sometimes because a lot of the data is backwards-looking, lagged data, and people have changes in circumstances. They lost their job, whatever else happened. And so we just get them to then demonstrate to us why that has changed and then make eligibility accordingly. But if it turns out that they had a job, weren't reporting or whatever, they would then not be eligible.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that. If you don't mind, whoever really focuses on that, I would like to sometime meet with them because I have some specific questions, especially with such a large area that I represent. And I won't take the time now, but I do have some specific questions. So whoever that is, contact my legislative assistant so we can set up a meeting.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Representative Backer. Chair, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your slide 9, I note a substantial ripple in the water, if you will, between fiscal years 15 and 16. And there seems to be a disturbance in the force, if you will, between total sources and total uses akin to about $500 million. And forgive me if you've already elaborated on that, but if you could just review for me what occurred during that course of that 12 months.
Ms. Minky.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in fiscal year 15 and fiscal year 16, so in fiscal year 15, there was a transfer of $455 million from the general fund to the Health Care Access Fund, and that transfer was received in fiscal year 15 but spent in fiscal year 16 on medical assistance. And so you'll see a spike in revenues in 15 without a corresponding expenditure. But in fiscal year 16, you'll see an increase in expenditure that doesn't necessarily tie to the revenues. But that's just a result. It's a result of a transfer in 1 year that's not spent until the following year.
And so with that transfer in, what was the cause or the need for that transfer in?
Ms. Minky.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the transfer was directed by the legislature.
I'm looking also at the back of your explanatory, and I note a couple of outliers in fiscal year 16 under uses with regard to medical assistance, as well as another outlier being in the fiscal year 16 for medical assistance, a transfer out. I'm just wondering if you could elaborate in terms of why those are not in line with the other years going forward.
Thanks, Representative Albright. And for members, Representative Albright is referring to the Healthcare Access Fund spreadsheet, which has the bar graph on the back, which has the fund balances and also the revenues. And this has the corrected revenue for the fund. So if you want to refer to that, Ms. Mingy, all the members do have this in their packet. Ms. Mingy.
Mr. Chair, the higher expenditure in medical assistance in 2016 is the spending that I was just alluding to associated with the fiscal 15 transfer. You are right that it is dramatically higher in that year than in sort of any of the year or years around it. In the transfers out, can I clarify, are you alluding to, are you talking about the first medical assistance transfer, the $48 million? So the this transfer is the transfer I talked about at the beginning. It's sort of the general fund or the medical assistance share of this rate increase to pay the provider in premium tax. And in the last, so in the 2016 legislative session, the legislature increased the value of that transfer. So historically, it had been set at $48 million a year. We recalculated it to reflect sort of the actual value of that rate increase, which is has now reached $122 million a year. So that was also a change in last session.
Thank you. And Ms. Mingy, could you say the 400 some odd million dollar transfer out, had that not taken place, would that have precipitated a reduction in the health or in the 2% provider tax?
Mr. Chair, I think the we're talking about the $455 million transfer in and then the spending. So if we hadn't increased the medical assistance spending in fiscal year 16, we likely would have had a provider a tax reduction in tax year 2016.
Thank you, Ms. Mingy. Representative Lunan. Sure.
Positive.
All right. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mingy, could you please, on spreadsheet number 5, could you please re-explain the transfer to general fund of the $244 million, how that works? So we've got a provider tax at 2% and HMO tax of 1%. It gets paid to the Healthcare Access Fund, and then we shift $244 million to the general fund, which then gets refunded back to the plan?
Ms. Mingy.
Mr. Chair, it's so we have to charge all of our providers and plans these taxes, but the state, in order to sort of, the state gave them a rate increase through medical assistance so they wouldn't kind of have any hardship associated with paying the tax when we applied it to these providers and plans in the early 2000s. And so that's where the rate increase originated. It's essentially the providers and plans are paying the provider tax on behalf of services that they administer to public program enrollees. And that's funded through a medical assistance rate increase, which comes out of the general fund. And so that's collected as revenue. And the revenue is just transferred back to the general fund. There's not the payment to plans is through and to providers is just through their medical assistance reimbursement on the front end. It's not, there's no adjustment done on the back end.
All right. Further questions for Ms. Mingy? All right, seeing none, thank you, Ms. Mingy. We do appreciate it. I'm sure we'll have you back to talk about this again when we have our next forecast, if not before. We do appreciate that. All right. Oh, Representative Grunhagen, I'm sorry.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just an observation. You know, I've been on this committee for several years, and there continues to be things that trouble me. One is the growth rate of the MMA, which I tried to highlight earlier, at a rate faster than what revenues are bringing in. But the second thing is just the welfare structure itself. And I guess what I'm trying to say to other members is to be thinking about this. You know, let's just use Minnesota Care for example. That, you know, why would I work hard to earn more money and be ineligible for Minnesota Care? If I do, and I come off Minnesota Care, I'm faced with the bronze plan in my area, which would be a $6,500 deductible and hundreds of dollars in health care insurance premiums. So, you know, the other thing, why would I marry if I'm on a welfare program and marry somebody who's earning a taxable income, because that could make me ineligible? And I know several people in my community who don't get married in order to stay eligible for government programs. So, you know, the whole system seems to be set up to penalize antisocial or right behavior and reward antisocial behavior. And that is extremely troubling to me. I want to provide.
Mingy? Oh, sorry. Oh,
I want to provide a.
Glad you're chasing him away.
I think I'm being filibustered.
I'm teasing. Miss Mingy was trying to escape, and I thought you were trying to ask her a question.
Maybe she's on a government program.
No, she's not. She's
I'll finish here quickly. I would like to caveat, I'm not referring to the elderly or the disabled.
You don't have a question for Miss Mingy.
Not right off.
Okay, no, thank you, Miss Mingy. I'm sorry. I'm just teasing.
But
I'm
would teasing. Appreciate if she stuck around. No. So whether they're agency heads or here members here or people in the audience that are familiar with this, how can we restructure this program to reward right behavior and penalize wrong behavior? You know, give you one more example. Why wouldn't I get a job where I would or do something where I wouldn't have to report the income as taxable? Like sell illegal drugs. I don't have to report that as income. I mean, that's almost what the welfare programs incentivize here, is antisocial wrong behavior. So I've been trying to find a solution, and if anybody has one, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And tomorrow we're going to have Dan Pollack, who's already here, very early studying up. We'll have an MDH overview tomorrow. We're looking forward to that. Same time, I tweeted that we were starting at 12:30 every day. As you can see by that, I did not have staff check my tweets before I send them out. It's obviously 1 o'clock. Apologize for that if any caused anybody any problem. We're here same time every day, and we'll see everybody here tomorrow for MDH. Thanks. We are adjourned.